You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Today, more than ever in the history of education, credible online master's degrees are of great value. Introducing the Master of Science in Pharmacology program from UCI. The University of California, Irvine, UCI, is ranked as the number 9 public university in the nation by U.S. News and World Report. UCI is noted for its excellent research and graduate programs, an extensive commitment to undergraduate education, and a growing number of professional schools and programs of academic importance and social significance. Fall registration is now open. Apply today at sites.uci.edu/mspharmacology to learn more and reserve your seat by June 15th, 2020. That's sites.uci.edu/mspharmacology and reserve your seat today. The deadline is June 15th, 2020.
Pharmacy Podcast Nation, welcome back to the Pharmacy Podcast. We are talking addiction medicine today. That's a special subject for me. I spent 3.5 years with an organization called New Season, owned by Colonial Management Group out of Maitland, Florida, who concentrates on medication-assisted treatment, 82 different territories throughout the country. And I worked with some amazing healthcare professionals, as well as pharmacists who are really drilling down into the patient's whole life. I really tried to start a pilot with New Season. We started one of these pilots in Tampa, and we were trying to say, you know, you're going to get a better outcome with regards to the Medicaid spend and the insurance spend to cover the health of these sufferers of OUD, opioid usage disorder, if you have a pharmacist oversight ongoing. And that's something that I truly believed in. I actually wanted to design a white paper. Maybe that's coming in the future. But today we'd like to kick off a new series, part of the Pharmacy Podcast Nation, interviewing pharmacists who are in addiction medicine, addiction recovery, supporting patients out there who are suffering with drug addiction. This doesn't just have to be opioid usage disorder, because we're going to get into even alcoholism and other drugs, even prescription drugs, which is where a lot of these addictions start. But today I want to welcome Dr. Katie Taylor, PharmD, to the podcast. It's her first time on the Pharmacy Podcast Network, Katie, and we are excited to have you.
Well, thank you very much, Todd. I am very excited to be here with you today.
So we're going to kick off this show, and you being the first of this new series, which that's exciting in and of itself. And you know so many pharmacists and leaders in healthcare that I am huge fans of. We just got done talking about Dr. Jeffrey Fuden's new podcast, Under the Care Collaboration, under the subject of neuropathic pain in end-stage renal disease. And he was amazing on episode. If you haven't listened to that episode, Pharmacy Podcast listeners, that's 989. Very easy to find if you just Google Jeffrey Fuden Pharmacy Podcast. And then we've also interviewed several other pharmacists that you know yourself and have worked with, Katie. So let's talk about you first before we get into today's subject. Give our listeners just a little background on you.
Hi, thanks. It's a long story. I've been practicing since 2006. I basically graduated with the time where the PharmD was the shiny new penny. So no residency or anything like that. I jumped straight into clinical practice. And because I had a 5-week API rotation in critical care, a hospital made me their critical care pharmacist. So my entire career has kind of been a cornerstone of learning by doing. So jumped in, and this was in upstate New York, kind of a little bit north of New York City, and just started treating patients in critical care. I went into every room, saw everything that was happening, every procedure with the patient and the intensivist. And through that, I saw many, many, many patients with, like, critical care, every single diagnosis you could possibly imagine. being where I was located in, you know, kind of an inner city, lower socioeconomic space, I saw an incredible amount of people with drug addiction and drug-related issues, either in the, you know, acute state of a, you know, a toxidrome, an overdose, or in a later stage where their organs have started to shut down and they had end stage organ disease from some of these lifetimes of drug abuse. And we hadn't taken anything about this in pharmacy school. We didn't have much knowledge about this. So I learned by doing. I threw myself into learning about these drugs, learning about the pharmacology, learning what to do and not to do when somebody came in with a toxidrome or an intoxication on these things, which things were contraindicated, what were some of the drug interactions and some of the other things that happened. So really just kind of built up my expertise on the ground, case by case, as I saw patients. And over 14 years of clinical practice, working at a number of different institutions, culminating in one in Maine, which is huge as far as opioid use disorder, I basically put together a pretty strong armamentarium personally for how to treat, deal with these patients. I worked with our local IMAT team, so our medication-assisted treatment. I helped a lot with the cardiothoracic surgery program because we would have to get patients on and off buprenorphine to get their, you know, infective endocarditis in their new valve placed with cardiothoracic surgery and then transition them back to their methadone, their Suboxone. I served on the opioid use disorder committee at that place, but it almost wasn't enough for me. I couldn't just focus on some of these patients. And I feel like there's not enough education in this space in the medical world or even in our world in general. I mean, we all know stigma is a huge problem and everyone's going to be affected by some sort of drug misuse or addiction. So a couple years ago, I started teaching drugs and society at Worcester State University, which basically talks about every drug we use and abuse in our society and all of the interaction of policy and law and crime and media and all of these other influences to basically teach my students to be critical thinkers for themselves. So when they see a headline or they see an addict, they don't automatically go and jump to some of the bad stigma that we have about this population. So I've just taught myself over the years and gotten more and more and more and more in depth with this stuff. So now I teach academically, but I also still practice, you know, in the critical care setting and have a very, very soft spot for these patients that are so misunderstood, not only socially, but you know, pharmacologically and medically by not just pharmacists, but all members of the healthcare environment. And that's kind of what brings us up to speed today.
That's amazing, Katie. I love the fact that you are delivering an edge to students, future pharmacists, residents, and the organizations that you're involved with by understanding stigma and not just coming at it from a scientific perspective, which is your backing and that's your platform because that's where you're needed. But that stigma side of it, the human side of this, the emotion side of this, the empathy that you have to have as a opioid usage disorder treatment provider or even a drug addiction treatment provider is huge because the attitude is the starting point. And then you're backing that attitude up with so much of the experience and education and expertise that you have. You and I are friends and you're a colleague, not so much me because I'm just a podcaster. And then we had special guest, Dr. Mark Garofoli, who is Director of Experiential Learning at West Virginia School of Pharmacy. And talking about education, share with us what you told me before we started recording about this new certificate program.
Yeah, this actually launched this week. Ironically enough, they planned it to launch on 4/20, April 20th. This is a substance abuse pharmacist specialty certification program that was created by Mark as well as freece.com. And it's a 20-hour, you know, online certificate program delving into every drug of use and abuse in the kind of the illicit area. We also talk about benzodiazepines and opioids and whatever, but you'll also learn about hallucinogens and you'll also learn about inhalants and a lot of the things that are there, as well as what is the policy, the drug policy that has gotten us to this point. And then finally going to wrap it up with what is treatment? What do we do now? but really giving, this is for pharmacists only, so it's CE, but it really ends with a certificate program. And it, to my knowledge, it's the first of its kind that is just, you know, focused on pharmacists to really become, you know, experts in this area. The thing is, I don't care where you practice as a pharmacist, you will encounter substance use and substance abuse. So I think it's imperative for us to understand, if nobody else, because just because this is not in a curriculum necessarily or an FDA-approved drug does not mean that it is not a drug and we should not have a really in-depth knowledge of it.
So if a pharmacist is listening, and the very first pharmacist I think of is the community pharmacist. Mm-hmm. It, we had Dan Schneider on twice on the Pharmacy Podcast, and he, back in the 90s, recognized issues with opioid consumption for pain management and how it started out as something very meaningful, very controlled, and then it cascaded into a disaster. And now we know it as the opioid epidemic. And there's so many factors in where that came from and how it became such an epidemic, which included nefarious practices from the opioid manufacturers and what they did in targeting certain areas and dumping millions and millions of doses into certain territories and communities that was above and beyond what was necessary. But as a pharmacist in the community environment, what's your recommendation if they wanted to literally build a program within their pharmacy? And what components do you think they need? As an example, do they need to be partnering with an MAT center to ensure that there are counselors involved in this? Or do you think that a pharmacy, a community pharmacy, is literally capable of doing it on their own?
I think it really depends on the community pharmacy and, furthermore, the community pharmacist. This sort of information, this sort of patient population, I almost feel has to be, you know, come from a place of love. These are not always easy patients to deal with. These are not patients who necessarily are incredibly healthcare connected. So it's really can be a challenge to not only treat these patients, but to get the information out of them. Because of the illegal nature of this practice, you know, and many of these medications, these patients are not going to be necessarily forthcoming with you about what they're using, how they're using it. So I think really the first step for any community pharmacist is to become, you know, familiar with these drugs themselves. Like, they need to understand what it is, what are some of the signs, what are some of the effects that they could get, why a patient would be using this. And even along with that, what are some of the adulterants that are involved? What are some of the other contaminants that are in there? And what are some of the effects that can come from them? So just have a base understanding of the drugs themselves. The second, starting to move this into a med rec. So when you are talking to patients about the medications they're on, we need to start having questions about other substances. You know, there's always been a push for what herbals do you take, what over the counter, because that's not necessarily caught in any other way. The same goes through for these drugs. You know, just because they don't have a prescription for them does not mean they're not using them. So we really need to, in a gentle way, start to delve into what are the other substances that you're putting into your body, at what frequency, what kind of dose. And then if you're having any questions or side effects or problems with that, because the first time that we have contact with them could be in the community pharmacy. And we have found that we are incredibly 80% disconnected with our substance abuse population. If we can up that number a little bit, like we can actually be more connected to them, we can get them too. So I don't think the first step has to be, you know, we have a formal program with an MAT sort of situation. The first is really becoming a safe and welcome space that you can understand and have some of these patients be able to share with you that the substance use is actually going on. Because the longer we keep it in the dark and don't shine a light on it, we won't be able to even, you know, refer them to an MAT because we won't know to begin with.
There are professionals out there, Katie, that you know very well, as mm-hmm. well as I do, some in the healthcare community, some nurses, some doctors, some pharmacists who have become addicted to something yes. based on an injury or based on stress or based on something. So I think there is an entire opportunity for pharmacists to, just like you said, from an empathetic perspective, to embrace these individuals in privacy and in the utmost, you know, respect to help them, because there are a cascade and there's this domino effect in the communities where you're having a healthcare provider addicted as well, which I think impedes the care and the treatment for patients within that community that they may be also in contact with. So what element of the healthcare professional, how does that differentiate when you're managing or wanting to engage a healthcare professional that you have suspicion or they've reached out to you? How does that dynamic change things?
It's even harder. And the numbers are somewhere between 20 to 25% of healthcare providers will have an addiction issue at some point in their career. I've known more than a handful in my career who have had problems, and it can vary across the board. It can be alcohol, it can be prescription drugs they get legally, it can be stealing from their institution. And so there's so many things in there, because in addition to a criminality piece that, you know, anybody might face, they also have the threat of loss of livelihood. Most states, however, have programs with their state board of pharmacy or their state licensure board, if you're an MD or you're a nurse, that if you voluntarily give up your license, you can go through a treatment program and not lose your license, be able to practice when you're out on the other side. Still, that's a high barrier of fear. So again, coming at it from an empathetic, gentle place is really best. And making them aware that such resources are available. Not everyone knows they're available, but at the same token, rather than what's on the line is not only their profession, their health, but the health of their patients. So that's kind of, we're caregivers first. So I think almost leaning on that caregiver piece to try to be empathetically, but persuasive at the same time. It's very, very delicate. And this might not be something that people come to voluntarily, but it's even more important, I believe, because the ripple effect, like you said, the cascade of healthcare providers is even further. So really, in any way possible, trying to get them into a program where they can receive help but maintain their license for when they're recovered, I think is imperative.
I really like hearing that from someone on the inside, because you have experienced and understand the embarrassment of being a healthcare professional having to cope with this disease that is started out as probably, like I said, it could have been an injury or could have been some stress. But nonetheless, it's amazing to hear you say that, because you're setting the stage to lower the guard of those individuals and then pass that on to another worker, a technician, another pharmacist, a physician, where we have to understand that there's a perceived stigma. Even if you don't have a stigma yourself, it's still perceived. There's still an embarrassment about this just because of the way that it's come about and the light that's been shined on this subject, which has been incredible, because now it's not in the dark anymore, but it's still very sensitive. So
I also think too that healthcare providers have an additional level of complexity, because we are aware of pharmacology. We know these drugs. We think they were smarter than them. So there's often a component where like, oh, but I know everything there is about this drug. If I use it in this way, there's no way I can get addicted. So I think the level of denial is actually quite high with healthcare providers as well, because we are versed in a lot of these drugs and the pharmacology and, you know, how to get it out of the Pyxis or, you know, cover inventory numbers. We know the system. So because of that, I almost think that we think we're smarter than them. We're a little above, you know, above the law in a way. But that just means the harder the crash will be when we figure out we're not. So that is an additional kind of cloudiness in the picture for healthcare providers in particular. We have access, we have knowledge, but again, nobody is immune from this problem. But sometimes we think we are because of our additional training.
I have a question, Katie, and that is, what other disease state do you see as being the most common parallel chronic condition that accompanies a patient's suffering with a drug addiction?
There's so many. It's hard to pick one. Infection is a big one. especially for anyone who uses an IV formation of a drug. And that can be everything from the infectious diseases like HIV, Hep B, Hep C. Those are huge. Tuberculosis even goes into there. Infective endocarditis, which I see a lot of in my practice. So infectious disease is a big one. Then secondary to that is other liver problems, and especially with the alcohol users. The number one drug killer we have is tobacco. Number one cause of mortality in the United States, legal drug. Number two is alcohol. And this by far trumps the next one down, which would be opioid use disorder. I mean, opioid use disorder went down between 16,000 and 17,000 deaths last year. This is a drop in the bucket compared to tobacco or alcohol. So if you think about tobacco and you think about alcohol, those are the things that are affected. You know, if you're smoking a drug, if you're using crack cocaine or you're smoking methamphetamine, we're dealing with lung issues and those sorts of things. If we're dealing with alcohol, you're really going to go to liver, but even the neurologic things, you know, there's very few organ systems that alcohol does not poison. And then when you go farther down, you get to more of the issues with HIV, all those things. Sexually transmitted infections are also rampant because a lot of people will trade, you know, sexual acts in order to fund their drug use. So there's so many, because these drugs, when you kind of put them together in a bucket, hit every possible organ system we have. So as far as a concomitant, the other thing is mental health disorders. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of times people are self-medicating when they have an addiction and addiction to a substance use. They don't want to feel what they're feeling, you know, their depression, their anxiety, their ADHD, they're bipolar, they're schizophrenia, so they will use something that will self-medicate or escape from those feelings they're feeling. So a lot of mental health disorders will also be kind of the acute or concomitant, go along right with the exact same time. Eating disorders is another huge one. People who have eating disorders have like a 7 times higher risk of having a substance use disorder. So a lot of these will go hand in hand, but it's kind of the chicken or the egg. Did your substance use disorder possibly tip you over into a worse depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, or did you really have a bad mental health disorder and you're self-medicating? So it's, and then one makes the other one worse, and around we go. And that's kind of a bit of a problem within even our substance abuse treatment world. I'm sure you can speak to this, is we may be, you know, really focused on treating the addiction, but if we don't treat everything else that goes into this bucket, that patient's not going to be nearly as successful.
So when I think of rounding out this series to help our listeners, primarily pharmacists, but also physicians and nurses, to really give kind of a bullet point perspective on the whole life cycle of someone suffering with a drug addiction, I think of counseling and the risks of safety for them and their family members and mm-hmm. what that presents to them. I think of the world of dispensing a specific medication that doesn't become a crutch, but becomes part of an ongoing therapy with a schedule in mind and really helping them to create either a temporary or a lifelong therapy that's going to just become part of who they are and their health. I think of opioid and drug storage and disposal. One of our sponsors is RX Destroyer, who mm-hmm. has been on the show several times talking about proper disposal. So that's an episode that we'll definitely have to
absolutely check out. Yes.
And then I want to get you and I and someone else to really dig down into the PDMP utilization, mm-hmm. the drug monitoring programs, and how these can be enhanced through the integration with our pharmacy management systems, but then also the kickback of the data back to the EHR system so that the physician can also be involved. We have some of these systems that are amazing, but we have so many barriers to letting that data flow.
Yes.
And then let's talk about deprescribing in this series. Let's get some people on who are really passionate about understanding when there's cascade prescribing, especially in our senior population, when mm-hmm. they haven't paid attention and the physician's so inundated with the need for seeing this patient that now they're on 16, 18, 22 meds, and the pharmacist is the absolute expert in what that means to the patient's life and the kidney processing and everything that goes into that for deprescribing. And then also, let's also talk about resources. And that is someone like yourself that knows where to go for counseling, behavioral health, which associates 60 to 80% of those OUD sufferers out there, and other resources such as funding, such as other counseling. There might be a marriage problem, there might be a child care problem.
Yeah.
There's so many things that could come out of this. So I think this is going to become a very necessary series. I think that it's amazing that you really helped us kick this off, because you and I have been collaborating on LinkedIn for quite some time. Mm-hmm. But is there anything in closing that you'd like to say to our pharmacist listeners in order to take action with what would be considered a next step?
I think it's really important. And I still can't figure out why pharmacists aren't more involved in this, that we're not the leaders in this. Right. I mean, this is a drug issue.
Right.
We are drug experts. It's really baffling in a way. And when you're talking about all of these things, you know, proper drug disposal, drug monitoring, deprescribing, these are all things that pharmacists are right there on the front lines already. So why can't we just open up and include addiction into that? Is baffling to me. And it's a passion of mine. It's a pet project of mine. But again, I've done it by doing. I've taught myself. You know, there's no formal way that this is being done. So we're really on the grassroots, the beginning effort and wave of this. So because of that, we can really implement a lot of change now, because addiction's problem is going to be worse after this situation is all over. When COVID-19 starts to go away, we're opening up the world again, addiction's going to be worse than ever. So it's almost like this is a great time for pharmacists to start to enable ourselves to show our value and delve into the problem that's really going to hit the drug world full in the face in the next couple months and years.
Dr. Katie Taylor, thank you so much for helping us to kick off this series, part of the Pharmacy Podcast Nation. It was awesome to finally interview you, and we got to have you back. And I'm excited where this could go, because the information is valuable when everybody starts commuting again and they consume information that they can do by doing something else, whether that be exercise or driving or whatever. But this is important. So thank you so much, Katie, for helping us to kick this off.
Thanks, Todd. Again, I am thrilled to always discuss these things and share it with my fellow pharmacists, because I really think that we're the ones that can really help make a difference in this fight.
Absolutely. You were listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Nation, our new series on drug addiction and the pharmacist as the key player in the future of evolving therapies in that space of addiction medicine. And as always, we thank you for listening to the Pharmacy Podcast.